Welcome to Roadcase, the podcast that explores the live music experience. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Josh Rosenberg, and I'll be taking you on a journey through in-depth interviews with performers and key people in the industry to explore the magic of live music, how it can be totally transformative for both fans and performers, and we'll look at how they take it all out on the road. It's going to be a great ride, so here we go. Okay, welcome back to Roadcase. This is your host, Josh Rosenberg. Thanks for joining me for this awesome episode with Jay Blakesburg. I'm so happy to have him here. As I generally like to remind you and urge you as listeners to get involved with the Roadcase community, and I want to thank those of you that have supported Roadcase thus far on this journey. And if you'd like to do so, you can venture over to patreon.com/roadcasepod. That's our Patreon page. And Patreon is a place where you can support independent artists and podcasts and the like. You can find some goodies on our page, and you can get early access to episodes and such. And it's a great way to support Roadcase, and really appreciate those that have done so thus far. You can also get involved in the Roadcase community simply by emailing me if you have questions and comments. info@roadcasepod.com is my email. You can also find out more information about Roadcase through the social media channels, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We're at Roadcase Pod. We also have a YouTube channel, Roadcase Podcast. And a really easy way to support Roadcase is also to rate and review this podcast and subscribe to it on your favorite listening platform. So that's a great way to do that. And thanks to those that support Roadcase, and thanks again for joining me. So for this week's episode, we've got part one of a two-part special series with Jay Blakesburg, legendary rock photographer, one of my favorite photographers, and just all around great guy who's always got a good word, who's always takes the time to say hi. I see him frequently at a lot of shows, at jacket shows. He's just an awesome guy, and his work is just spectacular. Jay's been working in the industry for almost 40 years, documenting bands such as Grateful Dead, Santana, Neil Young, My Morning Jacket, among many, many others. You'll hear all of the names in this interview. He's done over 300 more assignments for Rolling Stone magazine. And in this episode, we talk about capturing the moment of a live show through the photographic lens and how to capture live music and what that means, whether it be a historical moment or whether it's during a show, trying to get that epic moment, that action shot, that incredible shot that Jay loves to get and frankly gets all the time. He's always on that quest for the killer shot, and really, if you think about it, it's capturing lightning in a bottle. I mean, it's this one brief moment of a show, and it's like so exciting and so great to see, and it's so amazingly evocative, and his photos just put you right back into that space. And I love how Jay's love of rock and roll really propelled him into this industry. You know, he talked about being at a Who show in 1979 and that power of rock, and how he wants to feel that. He wants to be on the rail. He wants to be hanging on the stage and taking those shots and being right up there, because he loves it. He loves the infectious nature of shows. And so we talk about that a little bit. We also talk about Jay's also involvement in portrait photography and getting involved with bands to take stills or take publicity photos of them, get involved in record album art, etc., inside cover photos and doing that kind of stuff. I mean, Jay said, yeah, he could make money at live shows essentially, but really wants to make a living. He was going to get involved in portraiture, and we talk about that quite a bit and what his experience was in that. So we also talk about the visual and anthropological perspective of documenting the modern hippie movement and the Grateful Dead movement, and documenting pop culture history. And Jay's a deadhead, so we talk about the Dead a bit in this episode, a little bit more in the part two, because he's basically intrinsically linked with deadheads and the hippie culture. And but he also is involved with the newer jam band scene. And so we talk about, you know, what that's like and what the evolution of jam bands and the evolution of bands over time there. So very few photographers, maybe not any, that have been involved in photography for as long and consistently as Jay Blakesburg has. So I'm just so delighted and happy to have him here. And it's really, really exciting to be here with Jay. And I really appreciate him taking the time. And again, this is part one of two parts, and two parts will be, the second part will be also next week. So thanks for joining me for this part one of a Jay Blakesburg interview on Roadcase. And I want to also thank Jay for spending the time with me and spending this time with Roadcase. So we got Jay Blakesburg here for part one of his interview on Roadcase. And here we go. Hey, Jay. Thanks for being with me, man. I really, I'm really honored to have you here, and thanks for taking the time.
Sure. Thanks, Josh. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you've done so many, you've been in music business and the rock business and taken photographs of these amazing shows for so long. I'd like to talk a little bit about your background, but kind of to get started, I really wanted to talk to you about your philosophy of capturing live music and what that means to you.
Sure. So I think that my philosophy is to always try and get photographs that are on the more energetic, epic side, right? So The way the live photography thing works, and the rumor has always been that this started with Bob Dylan, is what is most people know is the 3-song rule. Right. You probably have seen a million concerts where you're on the rail or you're in an audience and you see 2 or 5 or 10 or 20 photographers in the pit. And when 3 songs are up, they're escorted out. Right.
Right. Right.
And so that's like the standard sort of thing in the industry. You know, as some of these artists get older, they start pushing the photographers back to the soundboard and make you shoot from further away. They don't want you to be that close to them because of the way they look. You know, people are in their 60s or 70s or 80s now, you know, some of these major rock stars. And so the rumor goes is that that was Bob Dylan, who was the one who started the 3-song rule somewhere way back in the day. And I definitely fit into that category for many years until I achieved, I guess, a certain amount of success and started getting better access and started asking for better access. When I started doing a lot of assignments for Rolling Stone magazine, starting in the late 80s and into the 90s, I'd start asking if I could shoot whole shows. And sometimes they say yes, sometimes they say no. Sometimes they say you can shoot 6 songs or 8 songs, or you can shoot the first 4 and the last 3, or, you know, it was all sorts of weird things that came about.
And when you say you're asking, who are you asking at that point? You're asking the band or the manager?
Publicists. Publicists or managers typically is where that decision is coming from. You know, right. And this is, of course, you know, pre-social media. So as photographers, we were still sort of considered the enemy, you know. Sort of like if you watch the movie Almost Famous, you know, the journalists, you know, the band Stillwater, you know, constantly refers to the Cameron Crowe character as the enemy. You know, he works for Rolling Stone magazine. He's the enemy. And and so that was the vibe that even was thrown at me for a long time shooting for Rolling Stone magazine. I mean, I've done well over 300 assignments for the print magazine starting in 1987. And so it just really depended on who the artist was. And then, of course, if you're actually shooting an artist for a record company, you know, then they would handle that and get permission. Yeah, of course. And eventually, with the advent of social media, people started to realize that we weren't the enemy. And every band had a friend with a camera. And every band had a friend with a camera that was willing to give them digital photos that they could use on their, you know, their brand new social media channels. Right. And all of a sudden it's like, you know, there's people on stage all the time. So like in the 70s, there were a lot of people that just had a lot of free access. You know, yeah, you could have been Joe Schmo. You had a backstage pass. You were up on stage at a stadium concert. Nobody was saying a thing. You know, and then you got to the 80s and it got a little bit more corporate. And all of a sudden it was like three songs and you're out. And then you got into like the 90s and the early 2000s. And then it was not only three songs and you're out of the pit, go to your seat and hang out. It was like leave the arena or the room with your cameras. And if you have a ticket that either you pre-arrange by advancing it with the label or the publicist or whoever, you can come back in without your gear, or you're just sent packing and you got to go home. Sometimes they provided a safe space for you to store your camera gear, depending on the venue, the band, all sorts of things. And of course, there were many of us that did everything that we could to sneak back into the show with our gear. You know what,
I've seen those guys.
Yeah, the Prince show or the you know, Pink Floyd or the Rolling Stones or Paul McCartney or Madonna or whatever it might be, because you want to get, you know, as much coverage as you can. You know, I've gotten to a point now where I'm typically most everything that I shoot live, I have full access to. Not everything, but most everything. Because I still like to go and shoot the Rolling Stones if I get an opportunity. And I don't have a working relationship with the Stones. So I'm one of those guys that's three songs and I'm out.
Yeah.
And, you know, so because I have a whole show to shoot or better access, I'm looking for something different. I'm looking for something unique, and I'm typically looking for that super high energy shot. If you've got three songs, or in the case of like some artists where they might give you 90 seconds and you're out, you know, you're lucky to get a shot of a guy standing in front of a microphone going, you know, with their tongue out, right? And so, you know, photographers are always asking me, like, you know, I got a photo pass. What do I do? What kind of shot should I be looking for? And if you have an assignment from a real magazine or a real newspaper or even a real website editorial, and you've got to deliver something, then you've got to get your safety shot, you know? And I always say, if there's 20 photographers in the pit, which isn't uncommon, whereas in the 90s, there might be three or four. You know, if there's 20 photographers in the pit, and everybody's on the right side of the stage, you know, house right, stage left.
Right.
And you go the other side. They go right, you go left. They go up, you go down. You know, take risks, because no risk, no reward, right? Otherwise, your pictures look like everybody else. And then you're saying, well, why isn't Rolling Stone magazine calling me? Or why aren't I the guy the record companies are calling? Or why aren't the bands calling me? Because you're a fucking idiot and you're shooting the exact same thing that everybody else is. And your work looks like everybody else's. So, you know, break those rules and don't worry about getting the safety shot unless you really need something to fulfill an assignment. And, you know, break the rules and try and be creative and come up with something different.
Well, but it's about capturing that moment, right? I mean,
absolutely.
You know, you're a documentarian of live music, you know, essentially. I mean, you do all sorts of portraits and other things and documenting the San Francisco scene and Grateful Dead scene and jam band scene. And those are all incredibly important works and beautiful works as well, your photography. But I'm intrigued by how you capture those moments and bring that fluidity into a still medium.
Right. So
So how do you achieve that? I mean, then, you know, talk about the distinction between that three shot rule and then the other parts of that, and how are your pictures better? Do you like that better when you have more access? You know, I see you at jacket shows and you're behind the drum riser, you know, you're always walking around back behind the stage and to get to one side to the other. I mean, the entire show, right? So that clearly provides you with a different level of access and creativity.
Yeah, access without a doubt is key. You know, more access gives you more opportunities. Do you follow baseball at all?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, sure. Okay,
so let me give you a baseball analogy. Because best advice I ever got on how to photograph a live musician on stage and capture the moment came from my Little League coach when I was 10 years old.
Okay.
And I tell this to people all the time, right? And so he used to always teach us this thing that when we were on defense in the field, to anticipate the play, That means that no matter what your position is, in advance, you say to yourself, what do I do if the ball is hit to me? So right. If there's a man on first and you're at second base and the ball is hit to you on the ground, your play is to second base. If you're in left field and there's a man on first and a ball is hit as a line drive on the ground to you in left field, your play is to stop that runner from getting to third, right? If you're the catcher and somebody bunts it and it's your play, you have a different play than the second baseman. You have a different play than the third, the left right. fielder. Everybody's got a slightly different play.
Yep.
So you think about it in advance. Okay, now there's two men on. What do I do if the ball is hit to me? Right. So when I go and see a band, knowing the band's music is first and foremost so important, because that's when you can anticipate the play. So I've been photographing the Grateful Dead and the Grateful Dead Experience now for 40 years. Mm-hmm. I know that music inside and out. And I know certain points that are going to be peak moments where I might be able to get that shot. And it doesn't always happen. There isn't always that confluence of musical moment, magical moment, lighting, body language, right? There are all these different elements that come into play when you're shooting a live concert that are out of your control, right? Sometimes, you know, a band might jump in the air. Like a new band that I shoot a lot is Pigeons Playing Ping Pong.
Yeah, I love them.
And they have a couple of songs where, you know, Greg does this jump and split in the air. Right. And they have an incredible lighting designer. And sometimes he's off by just a beat. And when Greg's at his peak spot, it's dark for that split second. Capturing light, and it's not his fault. It's just, I mean, it all has to, you know, he's trying to hit that and he hits that mark almost all the time. But if you're in the audience and you're visually looking at it, that split second of darkness where the stage goes completely black or it explodes to full light so you can see it, if you're just looking at it with your eyes, it doesn't really matter, right? Because you don't miss that peak moment. But when you're trying to catch lightning in a bottle at 125th or 250th of a second, and you need light to capture that moment, if it's dark at that peak second, for that split second, you've missed the split second because you're shooting in split seconds. Right.
Do you understand? Well, so there's knowing the band's music, and then there's just kind of being lucky and making sure everyone else is on their game at the moment when you know. But you can't know every band's music that intimately, right? So
correct.
Are you shooting, are you having more fun shooting it with bands that you know the music of, or is that just a better experience? Or it's kind of like a broader question about knowing the band, knowing the music.
Right. And I think that for me, it could be any or all of the above. I love shooting bands that I've never shot before. I love shooting artists that are super animated on stage, like a Pigeons or Lucas Nelson, who loves to jump on stage and crash on the ground and do somersaults on the stage and things like that. And, you know, My Morning Jacket, obviously you've seen them a bunch. You know how animated Jim and Carl and Tom are, and Patrick, you know, standing up and drumsticks and, you know, Bo, all of these guys. Right. So I enjoy bands just in general. And when I discover a band that I've never shot before and that's what they're like, I'm like, yeah, because it gives you more opportunity. There's a great band out of Sweden that I don't think they're technically together anymore. They're called The Soundtrack of Our Lives. And I got hired to shoot them in Sweden 15 years ago, 18 years ago.
Right.
Went and did some portraits of just one of the guys in the band for this guitar manufacturer. And then they came back to the Bay Area and blew my mind, because they're just like rubber bands on stage, you know, snapping left and right. And I just, you know, I'm like, oh my God, like, this is incredible. And I think that for as a visual person, it adds to everything that I'm trying to do, is bands that are doing Pete Townsend splits on stage. And, you know, the Bare Naked Ladies are a band that I work with over and over again for decades. And, you know, they're big jumpers on stage, or they used to be. They're not so much anymore.
Right.
Because,
you know, that does have a limitation to it. That 20, has an expiration date.
25 years ago, they could jump better than they could today, just because, oh, my back. But there's a lot of bands like that. But then you get a new band like Pigeons, and they're young kids, and they don't have bad backs quite yet, and they're like out there doing it. And you know, or the band Mo, I've done a lot of work with them, and they could be super animated and, you know, jump out on speakers that are in front of the stage, or stand up on top of monitors. You know, all of those things add to the visual, and to me, add to the excitement of a visual, of a photograph and a visual document, right? But you also mentioned something about earlier, like, you know, how I'm documenting San Francisco or the Grateful Dead or the jam band scene, which I am. And sometimes there might be, let's say, a guest artist, you know, like Les Claypool might jump up on stage with Warren Haynes and Government Mule. And I want to capture that just for historical purposes. And they might, you know, they might be a little bit timid on stage with each other. So they might not be at their full on blast off. Whereas, like, let's say you have Warren Haynes and Jimmy Herring who have played together a bunch of times, you know, they're like in the moment and they're looking at each other and they got big smiles, and you can maybe capture something like that. But maybe it's a guest jumping up on stage, and I use Government Mule as an example because Warren loves to jam with everybody, and they maybe have never jammed together. So they're sort of feeling each other out. Right. And you might not get the quote unquote epic photo, but you've documented the historical moment right here.
Right,
the two guys on stage together, Warren Haynes and Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters, or
Trey and Derek Trucks.
Trey and Derek, or yes, you know, things like that. Exactly. And, you know, the other thing is even back in the old days when I shot film, I shot way more film than most people did. You know, when I was doing three songs and out, you know, at a show and I'm in the pit, it was not uncommon for me to shoot 10 rolls of film in three songs. And most people were like, you shot 10 rolls of film? And I'd be like, yeah, what'd you shoot? They'd be like, well, I shot 1.5 rolls, you know, or I shot 2 rolls or whatever. And my philosophy always was, I'll never be in front of the stage at the Fillmore in San Francisco with Phish playing in 1998 on that exact date ever again. Right?
Yeah.
Once that's over, that day will never happen again. So shoot as much film as you can. And now that we're shooting digital, I'm even worse. Like now, you know, some people go to a show and they'll shoot 400 or 500 photos, and I'll shoot like 2,500 photos. And again, they might be shooting three songs, right? But I'm shooting a whole show. But still, I've always had a heavy trigger. I always have felt like, you know, shoot. Like, and for me, the other thing also is like, okay, now we're shooting digital and I can see what I'm getting on the spot. Yeah, I got the jump. Yeah, I got the growl on the microphone, or I got it, the feedback on the amp. And I know that I got the shot, and I know it's a killer shot and it's in focus and exposed right. But I'm like, now, how do I get the shot that's better than that shot? And for me, that's kind of always the quest, right? Okay, I've got the killer shot, but, you know, I don't just stop. It's not like for me, okay, it's Miller time. Let me go have a beer, smoke some weed, and hang out in the back of the room. I'm like, okay, I got the killer shot. Now, how do I get a better killer shot, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm just like this kind of weird little quirky personality that always is trying to outdo myself, you know? And
that's amazing. I mean, everyone has to have their own personal driver, you know, motivations, right?
I mean, it turns me on.
Yeah, and that's amazing, dude. I mean, but the first thing that comes to mind is like a practical question of you're shooting. First of all, I thought, like, how are you switching out roles with taking 10 roles in three songs with only like three cameras or two cameras? And then secondly,
typically,
that's, I guess, with the auto wind thing.
And then, you know, eventually the film cameras had a button you could hit and it would rewind itself. You didn't have to hand crank it anymore.
Oh, right.
So, you know, shoot a roll of film, hit the rewind button, go to the other camera, shoot that. If there's a time that's a break for a split second, you're pulling that roll of film out, you got it all in your pocket, you got your color in one pocket, your black and white in the other, you know, you're pulling it out and putting the shot film in your vest pocket, you're loading it up, boom, click, boom, get it ready, you know, back to the other camera. You're just moving as fast as you can. And, you know, sometimes you could do it and sometimes you can't. Sometimes you
can't. And now with digital, when you're taking so many different, well, first of all, you're going back and developing all that film in the old days, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's like a huge time consuming process, right? Coming back and having to develop all those. That's just incredible to me.
Yeah, but also eventually I stopped developing my own film and bringing it to the film labs, even my black and white film. So I was sending everything because I was shooting so much film, I couldn't even keep up. I mean, yeah. I'd go out and shoot a record company job, a record cover, or even a magazine cover. You know, a magazine cover, I might come back with 20 or 30 rolls of film. And if I was shooting an album package for a record label, I might shoot 50 or 60 rolls of film in a day. So, mm-hmm. you know, we couldn't even keep up with that kind of volume. And that was happening, you know, every day of the week back in the old, you know, heyday of the late 90s, early to, you know, really the late 90s, the, you know, dot-com boom of San Francisco and the record industry and everything else. And, you know, right. we were just shooting so much film. It was, you know, my bill for processing my film was wow. like $4,000 to $6,000 a month.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you started out taking photos for dead shows and for shows, sneaking your camera in, and I'd like to get the details about that. But since you started out capturing live, when did that transition kind of move over to also documenting bands just taking their shots in studios or going out and taking stills or getting hired to do that? And what do you prefer?
So I love shooting live music because I love the energy. So first of all, we all started going to concerts when we were kids because we wanted to be in the front row or as close as we could if we had that the seats or the ability, because that energy was so mind-boggling, right?
Yeah.
If you were, you know, in front of Pete Townsend of The Who in 1978 or 9 at a small club, you know, theater, like I was in New Jersey, the Capitol Theater, and you're 10 rows back, right? Yeah. The power of rock and roll was infectious back then, which is why we did it and why we continue to do it today, and why I see you on the rail, and you'll wait 2 or 3 or 4 hours at a general admission show to be on the rail at a My Morning Jacket show because you feel that energy. You feel that
two
vibe.
Or 3 or 4 hours, Jay?
Right. Okay. 6 or 8 or 10.
I was in Forest Hills at 10 a.m. that day, man.
All right. There you go. The day I met you, right? So there you go. You know, there's that energy. So when you're a photographer and you're shooting the band, you're in the front row and you get escorted in. Right. Oh,
so nice.
So, you know, I want to be leaning on that stage. I want to, you know, I mean, I remember like nowadays, if you go shoot U2 at an arena, you're 40, right. 50, 60 feet away from them because of all their walkways and catwalks and all this, you know, stuff they have going on. I mean, I remember shooting, I think in around 87, maybe it was the Octung Baby tour, and I remember having Bono come to the edge of the stage in front of me, and he was maybe 2 feet in front of me, and I'm shooting with a 35 millimeter wide angle lens, and it's still like his head to his chest. That's how close I was, you know. And wow. for me, that, and like, that's just mind blowing, that experience, right? So I always wanted and want to continue to do that because I love rock and roll, baby. But yeah. It was in the late 80s. I want to say it was probably around 88. I started to real. So that's when I started getting published in magazines on a regular basis. 86, 87, 88. Mm-hmm. Slow build, you know, not just like Relics magazine or the Golden Road, which were the Grateful Dead, you know, magazine.
Yeah.
But I did my first assignment for Rolling Stone magazine on 11/11/87 for U2 concert. And, you know, life-changing moment for me. Like I said, I went on to do over 300 assignments for the magazine since then. what I realized within about a year, year and a half of there is that when I'd open up the magazine, like if the photo editor, her name was Jody Peckman, like if she said, hey, can you go do a can you go get a live shot of, you know, XYZ band? Not for a live concert review, but for a cover story we're working on, and we need a live pickup shot that's new. And we've already hired so-and-so famous photographer, Mark Seliger, Frank Ockenfels, Timothy White. You know, the list goes on and on with, you know, so many big names, Albert Watson, you know, Avedon, whoever it might be in the 80s or the 90s. So I get a magazine and I'm looking, okay, on the cover is a portrait. Yeah, every once in a while, Rolling Stone or Spin or a big magazine would put a live shot on a magazine cover. Every once in a while, you'd see live shots in a CD package or on a CD cover. But in general, it was all portraits. So right. I start thinking, okay. And then you open the magazine to that story, and the first photo in the story is a big full page or 2-page spread of a portrait. from the same session they did for the cover. And then you flip the page and there's like a little half page photo of a live shot that's a pickup shot. And those pickup shots, they either assigned you to them or they would, you know, the photo editors would call your agency or they'd call you directly. Hey, do you have any recent photos of Paul Simon or Pantera or, you know, the Grateful Dead? We're doing a cover story. We need a live shot of this artist from that time period. Yeah, I got something. You'd send them some black and white prints or some color slides. They'd run a shot. They'd pay you $200, right? But I could tell the people who were shooting the covers weren't getting $200, you know? So I knew I needed to shoot portraits. And so I taught myself how to shoot portraits. I taught myself how to do portrait studio lighting indoors and out. And work with medium format cameras. I worked with a Hasselblad. So that gave you a negative that was square and 2.25 inches by 2.25 inches versus, you know, a 35 millimeter negative, which is horizontal or vertical, depending on how you're holding your camera. And the reason why you shot medium format, it had higher resolution, right? And it also had room to crop from the left and the right to make a magazine cover work. Right. And I started shooting in 4x5, and 4x5 is, you know, that's one of those cameras on a tripod where you've got a cloth over your head. Right.
Oh, like, okay. You
know, Ansel Adams, that kind of look. And the negatives from that camera are 4 inches wide by 5 inches tall. Think about that. A negative that's 5 inches tall. Again, higher resolution, incredible sharpness. And so these different cameras and these different lenses gave you different looks and these different films, black and white, color, fast black and white film, slow black and white film, Polaroid black and white film that gave you a negative, color Polaroid film that let you transfer the emulsion to a watercolor paper, 35 millimeter, 2.25, 4x5, long lenses, short lenses, wide angle lenses, zoom lenses, tilt shift lenses, toy lenses, right? So we had all of these things at our disposal to sort of create your look, your feel, your style. And we used them all. And then it all switched to digital and everybody had the same cameras, the same exact lenses and the same sensors and the same software, right? So, you know, going back to shooting, what made me decide to shoot portraits? I wanted to make a living as a photographer and I knew I couldn't make a living. I knew I could make money shooting live concerts, but I knew if I was going to make a living, I needed to start shooting magazine covers. And some of the first magazine covers I shot in the late in 89, I believe it was, I bought a Hasselblad out of the San Francisco Chronicle classified section in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. And I bought it off a San Francisco police officer, young guy, and he was selling a Hasselblad. It was probably about $1,000 used. It was 30 years old when I bought it. And that was my first medium format camera. And I think the first thing I ever shot with that camera were the Indigo Girls. They were a brand new band. And they were playing in San Francisco at a radio convention, a record industry convention. And I got hired by somehow to do a shot of them and brought a little bit of studio lighting that I was just starting to learn how to use and brought my Hasselblad and shot one roll of, I think, color film and maybe one roll of black and white film. And the Hasselblad, you only got 12 shots per roll, right? So you didn't get 36 pictures, you got 12 shots per roll. And that was the very first thing I did with my Hasselblad. I think the first assignment that I actually shot for a magazine with my Hasselblad was a portrait of Boz Scaggs, who opened up a nightclub in San Francisco called Slim's that was around for 30 years and just closed during COVID. They were talking about shutting Slim's down anyway, I heard, but it did close during COVID. And I did a portrait of Boz with my 2.25 Hasselblad. And I think that was the first assignment. But, you know, the photo editor, Jody Peckman at Rolling Stone magazine, you know, she never said to me, you need to go out and start doing portraits if you want me to give you bigger and better jobs. I just started kind of doing it on my own. And I recently was talking to her about this. And she was said to me, you know, I'm glad that you sort of were self-motivated to do that because I loved what you were doing for me at festivals and concerts. And she's the one who gave me 250 of my 300 Rolling Stone assignments, you know. And so another early portrait that I did for her that she wasn't even expecting a portrait was John Fogerty was in federal court in 1990, I believe it was, being sued by his record company, not his record company, but Sol Zaunt's Fantasy Records, because they owned all the copyrights to the Creedence songs because Creedence were young kids in the Bay Area and they didn't understand how important the publishing was. And the record company, you know, sneakily maybe took those. I don't really know the details, But somehow the record company Fantasy Records ended up with the copyrights, and he put out a song called Old Man Down the Road. Maybe you remember it. Big record, yeah. Solo record. And and Saul Zahn's claimed that that song sounded like Run Through the Jungle by Creedence Clearwater. Well, John Fogerty wrote both of those songs. So right. He actually got up on the witness stand in federal court in San Francisco and played the guitar and showed the jury how he wrote songs and why a song like this is going to sound like himself. Okay, he won the case, by the way. And nice. So I got assigned to do a photograph of John Fogerty. And we had a Rolling Stone writer that was sitting in the courtroom, a guy named Michael Goldberg. And Michael lived here in San Francisco and was a staff writer for Rolling Stone. And so he arranged with Fogerty after a court date one day that a photographer would be waiting in the lobby because I wasn't allowed in the courtroom with my cameras. And I had a chair and a little studio strobe light. And I sat him down and I did a portrait of him with his guitar, because that's what he did on the witness stand, in the lobby of the federal court building. And then I did a shot of him and his two lawyers behind him. Same thing. And I could have just done that with a camera with a flash on top of it, paparazzi style. But I knew I wanted to do something more creative. Yeah. And so these were the things that I was doing. And then I turned that into Rolling Stone magazine, and they ran it a half a page in Rolling Stone and full color. And it was a portrait and it was beautiful. And I was excited. And then I started showing some of that portrait work to other magazines. And there was a magazine here in San Francisco Bay Area called BAM, Bay Area Music. It came out every 2 weeks, and it was a newsprint, like early Rolling Stone. And I walked in one day and I introduced myself to the photo, to the editors. They didn't even have a photo editor. That didn't exist at this magazine. And I said, "Hey, I want to shoot covers for you guys." And they were like, "Ha ha ha. That's so great. Yeah, we'll get back to you, young man." Sure enough, 3 months later, they called me up and said, "Hey, it's Steve Stolder at BAM magazine. And I need you to go shoot a cover for me. Can you go shoot Camper Van Beethoven down in Santa Cruz?" And that was in October of 89. I'm like, "I'm in." So that was the first magazine cover for me. Another early one for Guitar Player magazine was with the artist Michael Hedges, a renowned acoustic guitar player who died in a motorcycle accident a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. So I started getting magazine covers. I started getting features. And then I started getting assignments from record companies to shoot bands for publicity photos, posed portraits. And right. So that's sort of how I built my career as both a portrait photographer and a live concert photographer. And
because I see you at shows, you're like part of the show itself at this point. You know, I told my son that I was talking to you, and he's like, "Ask him how he gets those shots, and how does he know to be behind Jim at during Victory Dance?" My son's a huge My Morning Jacket fan, because like he sees you, you're part of the band practically for him. You know,
play. Literally.
There you go. Right. That's what I'm going to tell him. Well, he knows that anyway. He anticipates every play with Jacket. But you're a rock journalist. You are recording, you know, the genre that you follow, and you're creating a historical record for that. Can you kind of speak to that now that you're, you know, into it 40 years, some odd 40 years, and what's your thoughts on that and your responsibility to rock and roll, so to speak?
So all of those things, you're absolutely right. So my daughter started a new Instagram page for me exactly a year ago next week during COVID. She was like, I want to do a project. I want to start a new Instagram page. And at first she was going to do like this retro fashion page. And she actually made a post or two, and she's like, "I'm not feeling this." She goes, "Can I start a new Instagram page for you called Retro Blakesburg?"
And I remember.
Premise of that Instagram
page. It's fucking phenomenal, dude, by the way.
the premise of that particular page is only photographs that I took on film. So there are no digital photos. Whereas my other Instagram page, Jay Blakesburg, just at Jay Blakesburg versus at Retro Blakesburg, is everything. I might post a film shot. I might post a digital shot. I might post something I took on my phone.
Me with my amateur eye just thought, these are just old photos that you took. I never put together the film. They're on film. Okay.
Right. So at a certain point, and I probably really picked this up in college in the early 80s, is that I took a class called visual anthropology. And I didn't realize that's what I was really doing until decades later, because like, let's take a look at my pictures of deadheads and music fans.
I love those.
Hippie chicks, yep. Right. You know, I did a book called mm-hmm. Hippie Chick about 6 or 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, the modern day hippie tribe on this planet began approximately 1964, 65 in the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco. We'll call it 65. Right. And the hippies back then were very, very different, you know, over time. And it's funny, I'm actually working on a documentary film about this right now, not about hippie chicks, not about hippies, but about this thread of this tribe. And, and so this tribe, there are anthropologists that go to South America, the Amazon, whether it was 5 years ago or 50 years ago, and discover tribes that maybe only existed at that point for 30 or 40 years, right? So the modern day hippie tribe has now existed for 55 plus years. And I started photographing it essentially in 1978. So mm-hmm. I missed the first 13 years, but I've got the next, you know, 42 years of that tribe. That yeah. is visual anthropology, right? That is documenting thing. So yeah, people think of me as a jam band photographer, but like, you know, go look at Retro Blakesburg today. And my daughter posted 3 photographs of NoFX, this punk rock band, right? You know, it was between that or Henry Rollins from the band Black Flag that she was going to post today. And she went right. with NoFX photos. And so I feel like I've got like a really good solid grasp and archive on what we'll call the modern day hippie movement. So, and the bands that surround it, right? At first it was just the Grateful Dead, and then it was the Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers. And then, you know, in the early 80s, bands like Phish came along, and then eventually String Cheese and Widespread. And now, you know, bands like Mo are 30 plus years and Umphreys are 20 plus years. And, you know, and now you have new bands like Pigeons Playing Ping Pong. And even though I've only been shooting it for like 3 or 4 years now, they're 12 or 13 years into a career. And Spafford yeah. and Twiddle and Goose and Eggie.
And Goose, yeah.
Right. So, you know, and MMJ. I mean, I shot MMJ in Slim's in San Francisco, nightclubs, 500 people. I'd have to go back and look at the exact year, but it was before Carl was even in the band, before wow. Bill was even in the band, right? And a guy named Sam Elkin, a good old friend of mine who I haven't talked to in a while, unfortunately, lives in Austin. He's like, hey, let's go see this band. My friend Mike manages them. I'm like, sure, I'm game. And I probably shot 1 or 2 rolls of film, you know? I was just there to check them out and have fun. And I'm like, holy fucking shit, who is this band? Yeah. You know, and then when they made that live record DVD at the Fillmore that Sam Erickson directed, you know, they gave me
full Okanokos.
You know, they gave me full access to shoot those shows. You know, Sam was a pal of mine. And he's like, yeah, you can come shoot. And so that's how I discovered My Morning Jacket and started my archive of them. You know, yeah. my archive of MMJ now is, you know, I don't know, several dozen shows. And I know a lot of photographers like, I just shot that band 6 months ago or 3 months ago. I don't need to shoot them again. And I'm like, no, I want to shoot these bands over and over again. Like, so you know who Michael Franti is, right?
Yeah.
The band Spearhead. I started working with Michael in 87, I believe it is, right? I'm 34 years into Michael Franti. I'm 32 years into Primus. I started shooting the Flaming Lips in 88 or 89, right? You know, I'm 30 plus years into these bands. So it's not just the Grateful Dead. I've been shooting Carlos Santana regularly since the late 80s. So there are all these different artists that I have photographs of for decades now. And I think there is a responsibility for me to protect that work, make sure it's available, share it, and recognize that it is important pop culture history, right? So I do speaking tours where I go out and I have a couple of different presentations. Mostly lately I've been doing one just on the Grateful Dead. Excuse me.
Yeah.
But I have one that also expands out onto other music and I'm actually booking a tour right now for, I think, the second week in June on the East Coast, sort of Virginia up to Boston. So keep your eyes and ears open on my social media channels and whatnot. But it's a 90 minute slideshow storytelling presentation about my experience photographing the Grateful Dead over a 40 plus year time span. And one of the things that I talk about in there is I talk about shooting deadheads, right? Because I've been shooting deadheads now since, you know, 1979, really. First year, 78, I didn't shoot so many deadheads. But 79, I started shooting some deadheads, and 80, really in earnest. And these were people I was on tour with and people I was friends with. And it just intrigued me as much as shooting the band. And now I look at this stuff and I'm like, whoa, thank God I did this. But the thing that's so mind-blowing about my entire Grateful Dead archive is that, because it ended in 95, first of all, the actual Grateful Dead with Jerry Garcia, not my entire archive, because it continued on after that with Phil and Bob and Ferber ones and Dead & Co. and, you know, et cetera, Billy, Mickey, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the time period of Jerry Garcia, it ended in 95. So what's unique about all of these photographs of all of these fans at all these shows in that magical musical moment?
What's that? It's all on film.
Yeah, but that's not what I was asking.
Or nobody has any iPhones and nobody has pictures any technology. And all that kind of shit. Yeah.
So nobody was dancing.
Everyone's completely in the moment.
Right. Nobody was dancing so there'd be a clip of them on social media the next day.
Right.
Everything was completely organic and it's completely beautiful. Original. And we will never have that again. None of these bands that still exist. Yeah, Phish started pre-cell phone and maybe String Cheese and Widespread, right? So there are photos that exist from those time periods. And I have pictures of Phish fans kind of pre-cell phone, you know, really the beginning of it. But essentially, you know, nowadays, all the photos that we take of fans, there are cell phones in the picture. You know, when I took the 50th anniversary Fare Thee Well band photo before the final show where I'm up on the drum riser and they turn up.
There are literally
70,000 people with their
people holding up,
up in their hands and up in the air to take a picture of that moment. Right. And so, but that's the thing about these pictures of these deadheads in 87 and 82 and 85 and 91 and 94 is there is no technology and it is pure organic, true visual anthropology of this moment in time that will never happen again.
Yeah. Don't you wish those times occurred? I mean, and your role was even greater then. I mean, clearly the distribution of photos was obviously so incredibly different at that time, which proposes its challenges and its positives because, you know, if you take a photo, you control the distribution, right? Mm-hmm. In a sense, and the distribution is slower, which makes you a little bit more in demand at that point. But wow. Just the differences of what's going on versus now So
I think I answered that whole question, but yes. And I do feel a responsibility. You know, I'm not done yet. I feel like I always say my Grateful Dead archive will be complete when Bob, Phil, Mickey, and Billy stop playing music and never play music again. That's when those archives essentially end, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I don't want to see those guys disappear, but at some point your body can't take it anymore. You can't tour. You know, they're all Phil's in his 80s and everybody else is climbing that ladder to there very quickly. And, you know, that's just
a sobering thought.
You know, like I've been shooting Neil Young consistently for the last 30 years, and I have a badass archive of Neil Young, and I'm so proud of my archive of Neil Young. And I don't want to ever stop shooting Neil, even though Neil has gotten older and maybe he's slowing down or has, you know, you're losing your hair. Like I want pictures of Michael Franti when he had no dreadlocks, little baby dreadlocks, full dreadlocks, and now going bald. You know, yeah, to me, that's right. Part of the story. That's part of the history. And, you know, there's like a local band here called the Mother Hips. I've been shooting them since 1993, I believe. You know, Jackie Green is still in the early part of his career. I've been shooting him since, you know, for 12, 13, 14 years. So there's a lot of new artists that I, you know, I joke around. I just shot my first album package since COVID began. I flew to Memphis, Tennessee last week. I'm fully vaxxed.
Oh, right. Yeah, you told me.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I felt okay traveling because I'm vaxxed. But I shot this kid named Drake Milligan, and he's a country music star, and he's got an incredible voice, and he could be a huge talent. And they were filming me and him a little bit for a little, you know, snippet of, you know, working with Jay kind of thing. And I was just like, well, Drake, now you're stuck with me for the rest of your life. You know, so the funny thing is that 20 years, when he's right. only 40 years old and at the peak of his career, I'm going to be 80. You know, and maybe I'll.
Oh, I know. I've just started to think about that. Like personally, it takes a toll. You know, I'm watching Goose, and these guys are in their late 20s, and I'm like, oh fuck, because we're almost the same age. I'm a couple of years younger than you, and like.
Right, I'm 59. I'm like, how old are you?
Yeah, I'm 57.
Yeah. So, but you know, but I love.
So yeah, I'm thinking like, fuck, when these guys are crushing it in their 40s, I'm gonna be 77 years old. Like, right. Fuck.
We're gonna be out in the audience with our walkers and be like, ah, goose, pigeons, twiddle. Yeah.
Don't bullshit me, man. That's when you're really gonna kick in the backstage pass shit. Yeah.
But you know, I do want to continue to shoot as long as my body and my eyes and my hips and my knees and. And my brain can hold up. I want to just keep documenting it.
Yeah, it's that beautiful arc, and you encapsulated it so beautifully about, you know, you came in at the end of the Dead. Well, in the middle of the Dead, let's say. I haven't really done the math. Okay, let's say in the middle, right? Yeah. In this late 70s, roughly almost the geometric middle, almost. But now you're picking up bands that are just starting, and it's that beautiful, the new documentation of the new jam band scene, let's call it, or even there's the mid-range jam band scene, and then there's the newer guys, and then it's just starting that again. And of course, you had precursors as well. I mean, you had, I can't go through all the names, but I mean, Jim Marshall is one of them, right? That was there at the beginning, documenting the beginning of these guys. And I don't know if he shot that amazing iconic shot that I love so much at the flatbed truck shot on Haight Street.
Of course he did. Yeah, I got it hanging on my wall right in front of me.
Oh, that's one of my favorite shots of all time.
You know, a couple of things on that point, which is, most music photographers don't work consistently for 40 years, right? Even Marshall started in, you know, the late 50s, early 60s. And you know, he had a good, I mean, he shot until he died, but the amount of work he was outputting towards the end was very minimal, you know, but he shot solidly through the entire 60s and solidly through most of the 70s, right? Mm-hmm. But the early 80s is, you know, he wasn't as relevant only because of his self-destructive behavior on his own, right? He was not easy to work with, you know, and most photographers, you look at most people's body of work, their archive, and even if they're still shooting a little bit today, most people, you know, they had their heyday. They shot from, you know, 65 to 71 or 70 to 80 or 80 to 90 or 85 to 95, you know, and I'm one of those rare people. I mean, there was in the early mid 80s, you know, I had to take a couple little breaks. I went to prison for a year, a little bit less than a year for a drug offense. So I wasn't really taking very many photos or rock concerts. And in 83 was sort of like my lost weekend. And then, you know, got it together, moved back out west and went to college. And, you know, wasn't really traveling that much because I wasn't allowed to, being out on parole. But, you know, tapped into a local scene that I was doing some shooting with and shooting some bands and my friends who were in bands that I lived with and really just shooting. I look at my time in college as an extension of that hippie tribe because we were all hippies and we were all in college in Olympia, Washington, and we were all very intentionally very psychedelic people, right? So even though I was out on parole and I was pissing in a cup, you know, you couldn't detect LSD in a piss sample. We were all just, you know, very, very psychedelic and dosing. And I was photographing all of that. I was photographing all those people over the last, you know, year or 8 months of COVID. I've been digging into those archives and scanning all those photographs and putting that body of work together. And my daughter posts some of that stuff on Retro Blakesburg. And again, you were talking early 80s and, you know, and no cell phones and, you know, very organic, independent liberal arts college, you know, scene, kind of like what Fish grew up in Burlington and, you know, stuff like
that. So just documentation of a different kind of quote, you know, sort of hippie scene like a later day.
And then I moved to the Bay Area in 85. And that's when I was like, okay, I'm going to start shooting again. And I want to shoot bands. And I got back into shooting the Dead again. And it just kind of kept going solid from, you know, 85, 86. That's when I was really trying to learn how to really be a music photographer. I was shooting everything that I could get access to, every band. I had a couple friends that worked at some record companies, and they'd get me photo passes. I didn't really have assignments. And then eventually I started showing that work to magazines and, you know, building that career. But the first, you know, 85, 86, you know, I was cutting my teeth into early 87, really trying to figure it out. How do you expose film properly? And what lens should you be using? And what film should you be using? And I'm self-taught, essentially. And then it rolled into the portrait work and teaching myself that. So that was sort of that arc in there during the 80s.
And you're in that particular genre. Do you need to be in that genre? You say you love that music. Obviously, you were a Deadhead. You toured with the Dead. You've seen hundreds and hundreds of Dead shows. And I know the kind of music that you really love because I see you at the shows and such. But how important is that to you? Now you don't have to, but I mean, would you have considered doing other kinds of, photographing bands that you didn't particularly love, or, right. You know, where do you stand with that?
Well, first of all, as we all know, you can't quit the mob. So, you know, I'm stuck with the jam scene and they're stuck with me for better or worse, because,
right.
You know, Don Corleone.
And once you think you're out,
right.
They pull you back.
You're never out. You can't quit the mob. So I have a lot of photographer friends that, you know, I have a really good friend named Kevin Major, another guy, Jeff Kravitz. Kravitz sort of straddles the jam world a little bit and shoots The Jacket and shoots Fish and Umphreys and bands like that. But Jeff makes a living as a paparazzi on the red carpet, shooting the MTV Music Awards and the Grammys and the Oscars. And but he also, you know, will go and shoot the pop bands and the Bruno Marses and the, you know, Janet Jackson. And I've shot Janet Jackson, you know, for Rolling Stone magazine, actually for the New York Times Sunday paper, actually many years ago. Shot her a couple times. But like back when I was first starting out, I was trying to shoot everything. Like I shot Madonna, I shot Janet Jackson, I shot the one thing that I didn't really shoot a lot of. I didn't shoot a lot of like hair bands. You know, I think I shot Motley Crue once. I think I shot Judas Priest once, but I never went after like, you know, all that stuff, all that LA stuff. I, you know, just wasn't really my scene. And, you know, I wish I shot a lot of Van Halen back then because it was so incredible. I did shoot Van Halen a couple times. You know, I've become really good friends with Sammy Hagar and have shot him, you know, over the years many times. Haven't shot him in many, many years at this point, but for a while there, I did a Rolling Stone magazine assignment with him in 89 where it was a portrait and he's on his mountain bike and he's jumping and doing a full split in the air with the Golden Gate Bridge behind him. And he loved that photograph, and that's how we became friends. And I did a bunch of work with him over the years and told him to stop for whatever reason. But, you know, I'm basically at the point. And so anyway, but Kevin Major, he's like the king of shooting every single band. He's Switzerland. He'll come and shoot. You know, he was at the Dead at Madison Square Garden with me a few years ago because his client was American Express. And that show was an American Express. It was a free concert. Right. And it was sponsored by American Express, and you had to somehow win a ticket. Right. But he, you know, he's out there with, you know, he's Lady Gaga's photographer. He did all the rehearsal photos for the Michael Jackson tour that never happened. You know, he was Prince's photographer. You know, he would shoot anything, and he's got an incredible body of work. And I would love to shoot Prince, and I've shot Prince a few times, and he's, you know, sometimes he's the Rolling Stones photographer, right? So Kevin has this other different career, but he'll, you know, he's just as happy shooting Billie Eilish and Lady Gaga and, you know, Christina Aguilera or Shakira or whoever it might be. You know, he shoots all of that stuff all the time, and I just have no interest. I just have zero. The music doesn't move me, and but maybe 25 years ago, if I was still 25 years old or 30 years old and I was trying to build a body of work and a career, I might have been chasing those bands today. But I have no interest in shooting those artists. I like shooting the artists that I like. I like shooting artists that I resonate with. Like this kid that I shot in Memphis, you know, he's brand new. They sent me his record. I'm like, I like this music. This is really good. He's got good songs. There's great production. He's got an incredible voice. You know, I can get behind this. I mean, I was Smash Mouth's photographer for 3 records. You know, they're still friends of mine. I did a lot of work with those guys. And my kids love that. And I got deep into their records beyond the big radio hits. And they were incredible songwriters. You know, right. So, you know, I'm not opposed to it, but it's like, I just don't chase that stuff anymore because I just don't really have any interest. You know, I'm happy discovering and working with the new, you know, and I've said it numerous times, the Twiddles, the Pigeons, the Goose, the Eggy, Spafford, you know, and, you know, Karina Reichman and Marco Benevento and, you know, Government Mule, and not that they're a new band, but you know, the bands in our scene, you know, there's so many of them. And I love shooting them, and I love their music, and I love them as friends. And, you know, I'll shoot them forever.
Is it easier to shoot when you're friends with the band? I mean, we go back to that Almost Famous question, but I mean, has that attitude kind of changed a little bit? And do you get better access for kind of cool behind the scenes shots? And, you know, what does that kind of look like for you these days?
Yes.
And is there kind of an age thing going on these days?
Yes. Well, some of the bands, there's an age thing. But like, you know, I've become really good friends with the guys in both Twiddle and Pigeons Playing Ping Pong. And I've become recent friends with the Goose guys. But like Twiddle.
Well, I love those pictures you took with the Pigeons and Goose in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Like the park in Pacific Heights.
Those were beautiful. Exactly. Yeah. And that was my first shoot with Goose, but that was like my third or fourth shoot with Pigeons. Mm-hmm. You know what? I have a good rapport with those guys, and I like being friends. So, there's a woman, her name is Jan Uelski, really good friend of mine. She worked at Cream magazine in the heyday. We're talking the Lester Bangs days. When Cameron Crowe made Almost Famous, she was an advisor because she worked with him at Cream.
And so I just read the biography on Lester Bangs by Jim DeRogatis. Really good book. Interesting.
I mean, DeRogatis was writing magazine articles for all these magazines when I was shooting for all those, right?
So they were on the show too.
Yeah, and
him and Greg
on your show.
Yeah, and Greg Kot, yeah.
Oh, good. Awesome.
They're based here in Chicago, and you know, they had Sound Opinions that just went private with that. It's off NPR, and it's kind of they're doing their own podcast and their own productions.
Great writers. Great.
Oh, my God. Yeah, great. Yeah.
So, anyway, so Jan used to always, like, she was a sort of a mentor towards me. Not that she was a photographer, but she had been in the business at the heyday. I mean, she was, you know, Kiss asked her to dress up and come on stage in the 70s.
Oh, right. Like I remember that.
Uh-huh. I mean, you know, watch the Kiss watch the Cream magazine documentary. And she wrote a bunch of it, I think, and is in it and interviewed.
Yeah, yeah.
So Jan used to always say, rock stars are not our friends. And that was a mantra that came from Cream magazine, right? Because there was this division, and that sort of came out in the Almost Famous thing. You know, there's this division, you know, we have an agenda, they have an agenda. The band, the band has an agenda, the journalist has an agenda. And for me, I prescribed to that for a long time. And I think that it hurt me more than it helped me because I was becoming friends with these people. And I thought it was weird. And I'd always say in the back of my mind, whoa, I got to keep my, you know, I got to keep my distance because Jan Uelski says rock stars are not your friends. And that has shifted and that has changed. And rock
stars. Well, is it different when you're a photographer versus a journalist? When you're a journalist,
well,
if you get too friendly with them, you might be hesitant to write, you know, be honest with the truth, be brutal, right? Is what the Lester Bangs character says, right?
Yeah, but it's also the same thing because...
But you, if you're friends with them, you can be up close and personal with a guy. You can follow him into the bathroom and take a picture. You know, you're just, I think it's from my perspective, is that an advantage for you?
Well, it puts you in a position because sometimes you can't show the photograph that you might take backstage. It's the same thing. You don't ever want to show your friend in a bad light, you know, and if you happen to catch somebody.
So you are compromised. You can be compromised a little bit.
Yeah. Like, you know, you don't want to show somebody snorting.
But you can ask, but you can still ask, can I do that? If you're friends with them, right? I see you in the Fare Thee Well documentary or like the film or whatever they repeated recently for the anniversary. I forget what it was called, but afterwards they show with the band, they come backstage and you're like right up with them and asking them to do this and asking them to do this and watching them interact with one another. But you had that access and that relationship where you can create shots.
So Jim Marshall always said that the most important thing about shooting bands is trust. They need to trust you and you need to trust them, right? They need to trust that I'm not going to show them in a bad light. I'm not going to put stuff out there. And again, nowadays, you know, we're putting stuff out every 30 seconds on social media, whereas, you know, then it would be in print in a magazine, it would go off the newsstands and it was sort of gone. Do you know what I mean? It sort of evaporates because, people saved magazines and things like that. But in general, you know, the material wasn't really, you know, but they didn't want it on a newsstand for 2 weeks or a month or whatever the publishing cycle was, right? So there was always the trust thing. You know, the Allman Brothers trusted Jim Marshall. You know, bands trusted Jim Marshall. And so I've always strived to achieve that same thing. And along with that friendship, I don't want to jeopardize that. I don't want to, you know, like I don't want to walk in on somebody in a bad situation. I remember, you know, going back to Sammy Hagar, I was shooting a live album for him at the Fillmore at one point. And I'm in his dressing room hanging out, and he started getting undressed, you know, to put on his stage clothes. And I said, oh, I'll leave you alone, you know, give you some space. He's like, no, no, get a picture. And he's like wearing his sneakers and his underwear, you know, like tidy whities that were dark blue, you know, and he's like holding up his hands and showing his muscles, and he's like in his underwear, you know, and,
right.
You know, he knew that I wasn't ever going to do anything with that photo, but he knew that I was going to have it forever, because he also is the kind of person who knows that he's not going to be 45 or 50 years old or whoever he was when I took that picture forever. And now
right, forever.
20 years later, 25 years later, and he's 70 or 75 years old, but that picture exists. You know what I mean? It exists. And he knows he can get it from me if he really wanted it. And you know, maybe yeah, I'll just yeah. email it to him. I'll be like, hey, check this out. I found this in the archives. You know, he'll laugh at stuff like that. Right. But again, it's a trust thing. And I think that I'm always striving to maintain that level of trust with the artist and let them know that I'm not going to get in their way. I'm not going to ask them to do something stupid. I'm not going to compromise anything. And if I do and they don't want to do it, they can say no to me and it's not a big deal. And I'm not, my feelings aren't going to be hurt. And, you know, we move on. Like, it's not like, oh my God, I can't believe I asked that. And they said no. And now I feel like shit. And oh my God. And you know, it's like, no, we're friends. You know, it's good. Yeah.
Okay. That was Jay Blakesberg in part one of this two-part series with Roadcase, and oh, I just love that episode. Talking to Jay was just amazing. I love his stories. They're just epic, just like his pictures are just amazing. And, you know, he talks about capturing that epic moment, and, you know, it's not Jay doing it per se. It's like he's just compelled to do it because of his love of rock and his love of music. And, you know, he always wants that killer shot, and he's very competitive about that, it appears. And he's like, knows he can get a better one. And he says, I can check it out on the backing of the camera, and I can see, yeah, I got that. But like, what's the next great one? And that's what makes greatness, is never being satisfied with that shot, you know? And I love Jay's dedication to the documentation of the music scene, also of the hippie scene and the jam band scene and other genres, and capturing what it's like to be at a show and capturing those people on the rail. There are beautiful pictures that he takes of fans just rocking out. And we talk about that a little bit too in part two, but he really has that sense of his own self as a visual anthropologist. You know, we talked about how in the studied anthropology, and just kind of sees himself in that role in documentation. And he's got that new Instagram account that he started in 2020 called Retro Blakesberg, where it's just shots that are shot on film. So they're kind of older shots of an older era, not too old, but he does feel, and he says, a responsibility to protect this work, to share it, and to recognize its importance in pop culture. And that's a really beautiful thing. And Jay fulfills that role, accomplishes that role, and utterly succeeds in doing that. And it's amazing. And he's my favorite photographer, just hands down. So I'm so happy that he was here. I want to thank him again for being here. And stay tuned in part two for more talk about Grateful Dead and Jerry Garcia. We'll talk about Jay's experiences as a deadhead and touring with the Dead. He spent some time in prison for a drug offense in selling LSD, and fortunately only spent a short time in jail. So we'll talk about that a little bit. We'll talk a little bit more about what it's like to do these portrait shoots with artists that just don't want to have their picture taken for the most part, but kind of have to. So that sort of duality there. We'll talk about some of Jay's favorite venues, and we'll talk about lighting directors and how those play such an important part in today's beautiful rock shows. We'll talk more about capturing the scene. Jay, of course, has written a book called Hippie Chicks. Again, the anthropological side, who's going to the shows, what's happening at the shows. And it's just such an intrinsic part of the jam band scene and the Deadhead community. And Jay just does such an amazing job at capturing that. And he's got a couple of books coming up, and we'll talk about that in part two. One is on psychedelic icons, key figures in the psychedelic movement, like Ken Kesey, Timothy Leary, Terrence McKenna, for example. He also has a book coming out on the history of blotter art. LSD blotter were often decorated with different types of images, and Jay's going to document all that in a book. So those are some great things to look forward to from Jay. In addition to next week's part two of this interview with Jay Blakesburg on Road Case. So I want to thank everyone for listening to this episode of Road Case. Again, I want to thank Jay Blakesburg for spending the time to chat with me, and I look forward to sharing part two next week with everyone here on Road Case. Thanks again so much for listening, and I'd like to encourage everyone to get involved with Road Case. You can do so in a number of different ways. You can email me at info@roadcasepod.com with questions, comments, and even suggestions for guests. Or you can follow us on the socials, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We're at Road Case Pod, and we have a YouTube channel called Road Case Podcast. And if you are able to and like to support Road Case, we have a Patreon site at patreon.com/roadcasepod. And of course, you can subscribe to this podcast on your favorite listening platform. And if you could please rate and review the podcast while you're there, that would be great. So I want to thank Waltzer for this awesome theme music that we have. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in and listening to Road Case. We have a lot of great episodes coming up, so I'll see you on down the road.